This is a truncated fundraising version of Behind the News. The last 20 minutes of the program are devoted to fundraising for KPFA. I don't want to make you listen to 20 minutes of fundraising, but I will say this. KPFA is what makes this broadcast possible if you listen to it on the web or on a podcast. If you like what you hear and want to keep it coming, please consider supporting KPFA. You can do that by calling 510-848-5732. 510-848-5732, or visiting kpfa.org on the web, where you can make a secure pledge. Look for the Behind the News premiums if you like. These are Leo Panitch and Sam Gindin's The Making of Global Capitalism, their story of the creation of the U.S. Empire, Matt Kennard's book Irregular Army, on how desperation for bodies led the army to lower its recruiting standards dramatically, bringing in neo-Nazis and criminals and very sad and damaged people with possibly very severe consequences in the years ahead. There's also a CD containing MP3s with the best of Behind the News, like about 18, 20 hours of programming, about 20 interviews I've done over the years. And then finally, David K. Johnston's book, The Fine Print, which is all about how corporate America rips us off. Those premiums and many others available at kpfa.org. So if you like what you hear, please consider making that contribution. And if you make that contribution, please mention Behind the News. Thanks. Now here's the first 32 minutes or so of the show, short of the 20 final minutes of fundraising. Hi, one more interruption before the program begins. This is actually the full interview, not as it says in the introduction, the partial interview with Leo Panitch and Sam Gindin. Full 45 minutes. Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. We're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Today is a special fundraising edition featuring an excellent new book by Leo Panitch and Sam Gindin on the making of global capitalism, the imperial project of the U.S. in the decades after World War II. We'll hear about two-thirds of an interview with the authors, and then I'll be asking for your support for KPFA. For your pledge of $125, you'll get the book, freshly out from Verso, as well as a CD containing the full 48-minute interview with the authors. More on all that after we listen to some interview. Leo Panitch and Sam Gindin have been on this show quite often over the years. As I say in my blurb on the book's cover, they have few rivals and no betters in analyzing the relations between politics and economics, between globalization and American power, between theory and quotidian reality, and between crisis and political possibility. Unlike many examples of the blurb genre, I mean every word of it. Their new book, The Making of Global Capitalism, The Political Economy of the American Empire, is a masterful history and analysis of the making of the world we now live in. Okay, let's listen to about 30 minutes of a 48-minute interview I did with the authors earlier this week. You'll be able to get the book as well as a CD containing the full interview for a pledge of $125 to KPFA. More on all that after we listen to Leo Panitch and Sam Gindin. Leo Panitch is the Canada Research Chair in Comparative Political Economy at York University, and Sam Gindin is the former Research Director of the Canadian Auto Workers Union. He also teaches at York University in Toronto. Okay, here are Leo and Sam. When did the American elite really start conceiving of its global ambitions?
Well, you could say it started conceiving of them with Teddy Roosevelt and even Taft in the first decade of the 20th century in some ways. You know, Roosevelt in his State of the Union address in 1901 talked about a civilizing mission that was somewhat different than the white man's burden of the British Empire. It was bringing the rule of law to benighted third world states who weren't able to protect
them. That kind of thing was not absent from British discourse.
No, it wasn't. But, but those ambitions were there. Now, at that time, it was about displacing, or at least getting into the spheres of the interest of the other empires. But you know, it was articulated and repeated again by Coolidge right after World War I, not just by Wilson, articulated in terms of the American responsibility to maintain what they called civilization, rules of law, etc. You know, and you started seeing the first American direct investment around that time. Nothing as big as it later became, but it was with that that I think you started seeing it.
But the American state at that point was still a rather paltry thing.
Right. It had much less capacity than it was to develop in the 1930s with the New Deal and then during the Second World War. I think, you know, there's a very famous economic historian, Charles Kinderberger, who says that between the two world wars, the British had lost the capacity to run the world, to be hegemonic, and the Americans hadn't yet acquired the will to. But it wasn't just a matter of will, it's what you say. They didn't have the institutional capacity to do it, really.
Oh, now, we're accustomed to thinking that the New Deal was mostly a domestic affair, but in fact, the build-up of the state had international implications, right?
Yeah.
Sam, you look pregnant with thought.
No, continue, Leon. I'll jump in.
It had international implications. Roosevelt's decision to, at this very famous economic conference in 1933... to break with the orthodoxy of the central bankers in the interwar period and to, you know, effectively take the United States off gold, to reject their austerity programs of the kind that we see today in this crisis, was in a sense more of a break from interwar internationalism than Hoover had ever done as Secretary of Commerce before he was president. But it coincided with a certain responsibility taken on from 34 on to try to, with the French and the British especially, to manage international currencies despite the beggar my neighbor policies of the interwar period. And by the end of the 30s, certainly the American elite, epitomized by people like Acheson, were articulating a responsibility by 1939, even before the United States entered the war, to ensure that the world after the war would be open to free enterprise. The American way of living would not be possible or safe if Europe in particular rejected a free enterprise society.
And I think a part of that was so important in the mid-30s was the recognition that to have that look outward required you to actually fix things at home. That fixing things at home was crucial to playing that, to moving out.
What aspects of fixing things at home are you talking about?
The depression. That if you were going to simply accept the gold standard, it would be a barrier to actually fixing things at home. So fixing things at home meant getting the economy moving, especially responding to the fact that you actually had people in motion who were challenging capitalism itself.
And we're jumping way ahead of ourselves here, but how does that contrast to what the EU is doing in the midst of its crisis?
Well, there is a certain banker's orthodoxy, which the German Bundesbank and the Central Bank of Germany has reflected right through the post-war period. People used to say that when the rest of the world was reading Keynes, the Germans were reading Hayek, and that was back in 1949 and 50. And the German Bundesbank in particular is very committed to a policy of monetary orthodoxy and to the kind of austerity that was being pushed by the central bankers in the interwar period. It's true. You know, it doesn't have quite the degree of weight in the world that the American Federal Reserve does or the American Treasury, and jumping way ahead, they've been pushing very hard on the European Central Bank, less success on the German Central Bank, which keeps opposing this, to do what the Fed's doing, which is to throw liquidity at the crisis. And what Ben Bernanke, you know, who is an expert on monetary policy and a follower of Milton Friedman, what he picked up from Friedman was that one of the things that drove the world into the Depression was precisely the squeezing of the banking system, of the financial system, after the 1929 crash.
And just to add to that, too, I think maybe this is one of the things you're getting at, is that the role of the euro in terms of having fixed exchange rates and imposing discipline on people has its parallel to the role of the gold standard in terms of enforcing discipline in a very rigid way.
Yeah, and Europe now neither has an Acheson or a Roosevelt to the coherent longer-term vision and the willingness to step on bankers' toes that the Americans did. But let's go back again in history. During the 30s and World War II, the American elite was quite consciously plotting the not entirely friendly takeover of the British Empire, wasn't it?
If it could be friendly, that would have been fine, but they were quite prepared to play very hardball with the British for giving them what was known as Lend-Lease, that is, the wherewithal to fight World War II. I don't think it was as narrow as wanting to take over the empire. It was an expectation that in order to get back to 19th century free trade, it would have to be the United States that led it. I think there was also a certain degree of disdain for the colonialism of the British. The Americans defined themselves in terms of their break, their revolutionary break from being a colony. And although during the era of Roosevelt, Teddy that is, they had acquired a certain number of colonies or effective colonies, that didn't turn out to be the pattern for the way the American Empire expanded. So, the United States was very much in favor of the decolonization of the European empires, and very much so, including the British.
Which I think what Leo's saying, what's so important about it is that it isn't just a matter of here's another empire that becomes the biggest kid on the block and simply replaces Britain. We're really talking about a different kind of an empire now that sees itself as in its own interest, in the interest of its own capital, trying to create a global capitalism that is open to all global capital.
So coming out of World War II, then, the experience of the 20s and 30s was very fresh in people's minds, and they did not want to repeat those mistakes, right?
Right.
So what was the plan to do it a new way?
Well, I mean, I think Sam should talk about the really important part of this, which I think most people miss, which is what was done at home. Most people who discuss this discuss Bretton Woods. And most people see that in terms of giving independent nation states a certain room for maneuver in the international monetary system. Permission, if you like, on the part of people who joined the IMF and the World Bank to have capital controls for a period, although the implication of, and certainly the intention of the Americans was that would only be for a period, and eventually they'd get to the point of where the Americans were after 1945, which is removing all capital controls. And that was important. I mean, I think it did provide a framework which gave a certain breathing room for the rebuilding of European capital estates. The bankers on Wall Street were not very cooperative, and were very happy to receive as much capital as could escape Europe after 1945, rather than allow it to remain there. Some historians have actually argued that all of the Marshall Plan funds really just was compensating for the escape of capital from Europe. I think that's probably an exaggeration. But Wall Street would have had the United States not undertaken Marshall Fund activities and limited the bankers in this way. I think Wall Street would have been quite happy to have, for instance, Britain, they insisted that Britain make sterling convertible right after the war. And it was a disaster. And there was a massive outflow of capital, and the British had to then pull back from the convertibility of sterling in 1946. So there was a sense in which the American state was not following what Wall Street wanted. In other ways, they compromised with Wall Street in all kinds of ways. But the most significant thing of what they did was they built the material base for empire at home.
That's the voice of Leo Panitch, who is a co-author, along with Sam Ginnan, of The Making of Global Capitalism, just out from Verso. All right, Sam, what about that home front?
Well, what was critical on the home front was dealing with labor. It was critical was integrating labor and taking advantage of that period of growth. Also,
it wasn't entirely pacified.
No, it wasn't entirely pacified. Labor had come out quite militant. You had a strong labor movement, and you had strong capital at the time. Dealing with labor and both defeating it and integrating it through the welfare state was very important also as a model for Europe, to move Europe away from just seeing capital-labor relations in terms of distribution, zero-sum games, but also seeing a certain kind of productivism. If you looked at the American model and American mass production, mass consumption, that this was a model. Now, the trouble with this was that it creates its own contradictions. As you get into the late 60s, you've got the contradiction with labor, that if the American state is going to take this responsibility for the empire, it has to deal with, on the one hand, protecting profits at home, because labor was strong enough to frustrate the continued growth of profits as the advantages that they had coming out of the war began to wear off. But also crucial was containing inflation so you can maintain confidence in the dollar. It was absolutely fundamental. So coping with labor after the 60s was fundamental to profits at home and to inflation and the international role of the dollar. So it was crucial to what was happening internationally.
And coming out of the war, a good bit of the world economy was in ruins, literally, in some cases. Trade was pretty much dead. So what was the strategy for getting things?
Well, there was a massive demobilization. And there were widespread predictions that there'd be a return to the Depression. There was no chance that through exports you were going to cover the effects of that demobilization of war industries and the number of people demobbed from the army. And what effectively happened, it wasn't a planned economy by any means, so it was a matter of the corporations often taking the lead, was this productivity arrangement with labor, whereby a high-wage proletariat, this is known in the literature as Fordism, a high-wage proletariat became the basis of realizing profits. Of course, what went with that was a increasing insistence that the radicals in the labor movement, those who had been so important in the mobilization of labor in the 1930s and even through the 40s, those of them who were communists had a certain legitimacy for a certain period during the war, not least because they supported a no-strike pledge, they were driven out of the labor movement. And restrictions on union activities apart from that were inserted in the famous Taft-Hartley Act. The union leadership accepted it, struck that famous settlement with capital.
This is the Treaty of Detroit, as some people call it.
Treaty of Detroit.
Is that like 1947?
48.
Yeah. Those are important years, like the CIA was founded, the Treaty of Detroit.
Taft-Hartley.
Yeah.
Another reason for their importance that most people miss, although you know it very well, Doug, is that the Treasury Fed Accord, as it is known, was established in 1950-51, under pressure from Chicago economists, from University of Chicago economists. And until that point of time, the Treasury had simply dictated to the Fed what the interest rate would be at which Treasury bonds were picked up by the banks and they had to hold them.
This was to finance the war effort. The Fed was just a lapdog of the Treasury.
Just a lapdog, and this continued right into the first 5 years after the war. With the Treasury Fed Accord, they then issued bonds through bond traders, and those bond traders, although it was a very narrow band, nevertheless, they were able to send certain signals about what the people buying bonds, the creditors, were prepared to take up bonds for, and that was explicitly a means of allowing bond markets to show their displeasure if American governments ran too Keynesian a policy that was too committed to full employment or to welfare expenditure.
So when you said that this was such a critical moment, it's so important in all those ways. You get labor generally being integrated, you get the defeat of the radicals, which is so important in terms of the future development of labor. You get credit starting to actually grow then very much, mortgages especially. You get finance developing. You know, we've talked about that in terms of this being, you know, this period being the cradle of neoliberalism in that sense, that all these things are emerging at this point in time. You've got pensions starting to grow, and that in turn means that workers' funds actually become part of the process of financialization.
Of course, it was still taking baby steps at that point. Wall Street was rather quiet, and people weren't making the big bucks in those days.
Nevertheless, when Rubin came on board at Goldman Sachs, he was told by one of the senior partners, you'll never have it so good as we did. And he came on board in the mid-60s. They had a very good life. It's true. I mean, they were incubated back to life, and the separation of investment and commercial banking was one of the things that allowed them to be nurtured. But they developed a hell of a lot of expertise by virtue of their concentration on investment banking, so much so that when the Europeans turned to investment banking, they followed American practices and often contracted with American investment banks.
So we sort of missed this, the story of how things got going again, how global trade got going again in the 50s.
Well, that involved a lot of nurturing of the Japanese and European economies with an explicit openness on the part of the United States, despite the fact that the first attempt at the World Trade Organization, was going to be called the International Trade Organization, was vetoed by the Americans because they thought that it had a little bit too much of socialist ideas in some of its language. Nevertheless, there was an explicit policy of allowing for European and Japanese imports into the United States without expecting a similar type of openness on the part of the Europeans for a period. They were constantly made it clear that that would only last for a period, and it did only last for a period. But nevertheless, that was very important to Germany and Japan becoming major exporters.
Now, this is an important point because the American elite at that point was acting in what it considered the broadest interest of the system as a whole. They were not acting out of pure, narrowly defined short-term self-interest, right? I mean, this is, you know, it's not the selfishness that I think a lot of people... The pure selfishness, you know, the pure short-term selfishness a lot of people attribute to them. They're really thinking about things.
You could say selfishness, but they certainly were thinking long-term.
That's right, right.
And they understood that the greatest danger was that if any of Europe were to leave capitalism, that the spread of capitalism and the spread of capitalist relations and the development of Europe was absolutely fundamental to American long-term interests. So it wasn't isolated, you know, didn't want to get isolated again and go back to the 30s where you had countries, you know, moving towards autarky or worse.
And the U.S. government is also encouraging U.S. corporations to invest abroad.
Yes, although there wasn't much of that going on in Europe, and even less in Japan, since the Japanese are much less keen on it than the Europeans were. Until the late 1950s and then the explosion in the 1960s. And for American corporations to be interested in investing in Europe, you first had to get the development of a high wage proletariat again, a working class capable of consuming in Europe for there to be an enormous expansion. Now, you know, of course, General Motors and Ford had been in Europe since the 1920s. And they were, in a sense, the only European corporations in the sense that they actually spanned borders in Europe. It was American MNCs, which were the first pan-European corporations. But the really vast increase of foreign direct investment into Europe when, you know, there's a tremendous shift from, you know, American direct investment being concentrated in Canada and Latin America. By 1965, Europe was now the place where American investment was massively located.
And the Marshall Plan was crucial to this. You're raising the question of the commitment of the American state and American capital to reviving Europe. I mean, without a Marshall Plan, you know, if you're trying to imagine Europe finding the resources for investment, it would have meant squeezing the working class more and risking the political repercussions of that. So the Marshall Plan was very important for that. And Europe didn't have the capacity to simply start exporting to the United States, even if the United States let them in, unless you were simultaneously helping them to develop. So they were actually transferring technology to Europe throughout this time, even without MNCs, just directly through exchanges.
Productivity councils, et cetera.
And the U.S. is aware that it was creating what would become competition over the long term.
Very explicitly. very explicitly. The State Department and the Treasury were talking this way during the war. It was made public in this very famous, or I don't know how famous it was later, but at the time it was famous, pamphlet in Fortune, Time, and Life magazine, which said, after the war, there's going to have to be a new American empire, different from the old ones. We will not have colonial civil servants. We're not afraid of having industrial competitors to ourselves. That's what capitalism is all about. The point is to get free enterprise going in every major European country. And
they more or less meant this.
And they really meant it, I think. Now, the they is one has to be careful here, because what the United States is happening to the United States, more than the United States is doing, is it's acquiring the burden of representing the world's capital, of not just representing the American capitalist class, but representing capitalists everywhere. And the move into Europe is very much empire by invitation on the part of their ruling classes, not least because in a good many European countries there's a very radical working class, often communist-led, but in any case, whether it's communist-led or not, often very radical. And they were quite afraid of that working class, the European bourgeoisie, and looked to the United States as their protector. And I don't mean a protector in the sense of the Soviet invasion. What the key to the Marshall Plan is not the threat of the Soviets crossing borders. The key to it is, will the Greek communists come to power in Greece? Will the French communists stay in government? Will the Italians, because they were in coalition governments after the war, with the right to strike enshrined in those constitutions, unheard of, and you know, this is very much an alliance between the European ruling classes and increasingly European social democrats, who are looking to a mixed economy, and the American ruling class.
Again, the voice of Leo Panitch, co-author with Sam Ginnan of The Making of Global Capitalism, just out from Verso. This is certainly a new concept of empire, with the United States at the pinnacle, sort of junior partners, Europe, increasingly Japan, your country, Canada.
Is the model.
the model model vassal, who is actually pretty well off. But now, what about the rest of the world, the former colonies? What was happening with them?
Well, you know, the book's called The Making of Global Capitalism because it is this long process of trying to make a truly global capitalism. But it's much more difficult in the Third World. The nature of this empire is that it tries to operate through economic institutions, through the social relations and legal structures of markets and the free flow of capital and free trade. In the Third World, this is much more difficult, and it's much more difficult in part because as they're breaking out of colonialism, there's also nationalist movements in there that are of concern. That's, you know, until the later 70s, you've got a lot of expropriations going on. So part of the role of the American state is to manage this in a way that tries to keep them within capitalism, that actually keeps resources in particular safe, not just for themselves, not just oil for themselves, but safe for capital, for this global capitalism that they're building. And you begin to see through the later 70s into the 80s and 90s, the beginnings of integrating the Third World itself. Much more difficult, much more uneven, full of contradictions. But, you know, you can say at this point in time, there's very few countries anywhere who are speaking about leaving global capitalism.
But I think the big difference is that whereas Europe wanted to, including most European workers by the 1950s, wanted to be like America, in much of the Third World by the late 1950s, you had the ugly American. You know, that famous book and film. And you know, even though the United States fostered decolonization, it was also seen as limiting nationalist ambitions. It wasn't uniformly so. We've uncovered some evidence that the State Department was actually promoting import substitution industrialization and looked kindly for a certain period on Raoul Prebisch, who was the great Latin American economist who articulated this. But by the 60s...
Better that than communism.
Better that than communism for a period. But by the 60s, with a switch, a Kennedy switch, of the United States giving aid to Third World countries to giving them loans, and in order to pay back those loans, they have to export. That was the dynamic that began to push these countries towards what eventually became the free trade models of the 80s and 90s.
Well, we had a few crises to navigate before we get to this point, though. Let's talk to some about these crises. We're skipping ahead, but people can buy the book and fill in the material, of course. The starting in the late 60s and into the 70s, we saw the U.S. lose the Vietnam War, a sense of just general loss of control by the part of the American elite. Inflation became rampant. Everything seemed to be sliding away in the 70s. That was the decade of crisis. What was happening there is your analysis, and then what did that sense of crisis do to for the American empire's managerial class?
We're speaking in the middle of an election campaign, and it was during the Kennedy-Eisenhower election campaign that the first great scare occurred about a dollar crisis.
Kennedy-Nixon.
Sorry, yeah. The succession of Kennedy from Eisenhower to Kennedy, and it was the 1960 election. And this was shortly after the Europeans had made their currencies convertible, as the Americans had been pressing them to do. It was in the context of the recession of the late 1950s, and there was a great concern on the part of the Europeans that the dollar would begin to lose its value. Just as they were developing their export capacity to the United States, it would become more difficult, therefore, in terms of a free-floating currency to export to the United States. Would the dollar be able to sustain itself to what it had already become, effectively the global currency? So the sense of crisis begins really as early as that. And the Treasury and the Fed, to a lesser extent, starts worrying a great deal through the 60s. Over how do we maintain the value of the dollar. And one of the things that's operating there is the concern that full employment, especially in the United States, because it's the model after all, is going to lead to inflationary policy. And that will contribute to the destabilization of, above all, the world currency.
And full employment at this point, was this the American Union's emboldened sense?
No, absolutely. And not just emboldened around wages, but emboldened around fighting back over working conditions, which unions had, in fact, given up to a significant extent to defend wages and benefits, but which affected productivity. So you have, in this period, as Leo was emphasizing, what's coming together is the concern with controlling labor, because that's fundamental to profits at home, and fundamental to inflation and confidence in the dollar. And what's crucial is that the Americans don't actually, it's not like they have this immediate knowledge of how to get out of it. They actually stumble, not just in the late 60s and through the 60s as they're struggling with the dollar, but right through the 70s, trying different things. They're trying wage and price controls, they're trying some stimulus, they're trying to see if they can deal with trade. Nixon has his 10% tariff for a while. So they're struggling to see what they can, how they can deal with this, and trying to avoid the kind of harsh discipline. There is some discipline, but the kind of real harsh discipline that the Americans are, the American state is unwilling to impose at home. So it's got this potential contradiction between its responsibilities and pressures at home and its responsibilities abroad. But by the end of the 70s, it has to deal with that. It has to deal with the dollar in the interests of American capital and, the continued confidence in the dollar. And to do that, it has to come to grips with things at home, which means the working class. And the other thing about it is, and it's not inevitable that they can get out of this, because the question here isn't just kind of a static notion of whether they have the capacity to restructure and get out of it. It's a dynamic capacity. It's a question. Do they have the ability to get out of this and to restructure their economy so they can continue to play that leading role?
There's a second contradiction you're offering here. The first one is the one that was identified by economists, Marxist and Keynesian, in the 1940s, that full employment would be a problem for capitalism because it would give workers a freedom from fear. And that's what happened. And it was very much the case that, as Sam says, if a boss told a worker to work harder, he might tell him, pardon the expression, to fuck off, because he knew he could pick up a job down the road the next day or that afternoon. That was one contradiction. But the other was that finance was outgrowing the incubator that Glass-Steagall and the post-war system had created for it. And you were finding American capital going abroad. You were finding American dollars completely unregulated, being traded in the euro-dollar market in London, from which was established in the late 50s. And by the mid-60s, both American investment banks and commercial banks are operating in London in a major way. And they're beginning to move in such a way as to get around New Deal restrictions on interest rates. So there's also, you know, we have to think that this is de Gaulle putting pressure on the American dollar by calling for a return to the gold standard.
Oh, in my youth, I remember he was the bad guy.
He was the bad guy. But, you know, it was also Wall Street banks beginning to move internationally and putting pressure on American policies that way. Now, it's true, you get 1968 in France. De Gaulle has to buy off a general strike by the unions, the largest general strike in history at that point, 15 million workers. And you never hear about going back to the gold standard after that, because that's automatic discipline that wouldn't have given him the flexibility to do that. But what's also going on, it's really important, through these contradictions, is that people like Volcker, who was at that point a very middle-level official in the Treasury, he ends up being actually the decision-maker in the Treasury by 1969 to 71, is building linkages with central bankers and finance ministry officials in the group of 10 countries, especially France, Britain, Germany. And they begin to coordinate in a very, you know, comradely way, as Volcker often describes it, policies which will be able to sustain the making of global capitalism under the aegis of the American dollar. That continues through the Bretton Woods crisis. There's loads of tensions between them in that crisis as the fixed exchange rates to the dollar are removed. They are working very hard to try to keep the whole thing going, while expecting the Americans, of course, to deal with their working class, to set the example in terms of putting an end to wage inflation. And as Sam says, it takes them the better part of the decade to do it, to the chagrin, above all, of the Germans.
The other thing that's important about finance in all of this is that it's both causing a problem, because there's a contradiction in terms of trying to have fixed exchange rates with Bretton Woods and increasingly mobile finance. So it's part of the contradiction, but it's part of the capacity to be able to go beyond Bretton Woods, to begin to imagine the kind of depth of financial markets that could actually start dealing with globalization and flexible exchange rates. And people weren't that sure about how unstable this would be. It wasn't obvious that if you suddenly moved to flexible exchange rates, the world wouldn't go crazy.
Well, that trade would not be undermined, yeah.
But that also out of the financial sector, a lot of the political mobilization for the crackdown came.
Yes.
The commanding heights of the capitalist economy.
And there was also divisions among them. The investment bankers are rising, and they're trying to break down some of the regulations and protections that the bankers have, etc.
But, you know, if you raise interest rates high enough to break the backs of labor, which is what Volcker did in 1980, the danger is you'll cause a financial crisis at the same time. And that's what happened in 1970, when the first attempt was made to raise interest rates and slow down the economy and break in that way workers' confidence. That brought about what was then known as the commercial paper crisis. Goldman Sachs was into it up to its eyeballs back then as well. They were the ones selling commercial paper. They were, you know, relatively small investment bank at that time. They knew that Penn Central, which is the fourth largest corporation in America, and a number of other corporations weren't going to be able to roll over their short-term bonds, which is what commercial paper is, at those interest rates. And they kept on selling them to municipalities, universities. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? And they were in the courts for 5 years in the 70s. And one, I think, the main reason that the Fed retracted in 1970 and rapidly reduced interest rates was that commercial paper crisis was saving those banks. So the banks demand discipline, except when it gets applied to themselves. It's been very common. And it took 10 years until the Fed, with Volcker, developed the capacity to be able to see through a very high interest rate policy, break the backs of labor confidence, and not cause a financial crisis.
Yeah. It didn't cause a financial crisis. But if you look at the 80s, there was a massive restructuring of banking.
That is the voice of Sam Gindin, co-author, along with Leo Panitch, of The Making of Global Capitalism from Verso. So we're running low on time, so let's talk a bit about the Volcker and the deep recession of 80, 81, 82. It was really transformative, and everything changed at that point in a lot of ways, didn't it?
Yeah, everything changes, and you can see the changes if you compare it to the crisis this time. At that point in time, you break labor, primarily through high unemployment, but also through direct action of the state and the Chrysler bailout. There are conditions, and Volcker was actually on the Chrysler bailout board at the time. The PATCO strike was fundamental to sending a message to business in terms of attacking labor. The Chrysler thing, by the way, introduced outsourcing as something to push for, in addition to lowering wages. You break the back of inflation. So in the current moment, we've got a completely different crisis. Now you've got a crisis that is linked to the weakness of labor and the fragility of working class families because they become so dependent on credit. Then you're breaking the back of inflation. Now inflation is a non-issue. Then you're worried about the dollar. Now you've got the dollar being very strong in spite of what Standard & Poor's might say in terms of the ratings. But what crucially happens is that in that interim, if you're looking at the 1983 period, the quarter century after that, you've got a massive restructuring of the American economy and internationally that revives and renews the American empire. A crucial part of that is breaking labor, but you see that in terms of the restructuring of industry. You see that in terms of incorporating the third world, major countries in the third world, into global capitalism. So this may in fact have been one of the greatest periods of restructuring of capitalism in history.
Yeah, and it's, I think, important to underscore that it was really quite successful from their point of view. I mean, you sometimes hear people talk about the long crisis that began in 73 or whatever, but that was, 25 or 30 years of very successful restructuring that made a lot of people very rich and powerful.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. You can't measure the decline of the empire in terms of what it is doing to inequality or to working people. It's a question of what is it doing for capital.
And capital has been mostly very happy. But now we're really running low on time, so let's talk about the crisis. That all started coming undone 2006, 2007, and then really blew apart in 2008. Still not looking so good now. So what's your analysis of where they are now? Are they up to another restructuring of that sort? Do they know what they're doing?
That's the $64 question. To some extent, the way they solved the crisis laid the basis for the current crisis. They had 25 years, as long as the post-war golden age, of a good run with very high productivity growth, etc. And they kept it going through credit.
Yeah, if you're squeezing wages and benefits, you got to keep a mass consumption system going.
Exactly.
Somehow, right?
And it wasn't only credit cards, it was mortgages, etc. And the working class was buying into it in the sense that apart from their home being the only asset they had, they were looking at what their pensions were returning on the stock market. And that eventually blew into the credit bubble the mortgage security market created. Very much fomented, facilitated, first under Clinton, but especially under Bush, through low interest rates, through this enormous flow of capital into the United States, which meant there was all this money sloshing around to go into the credit markets, and through banks around the world being more than happy to buy, anxious to buy, American mortgage securities because they thought they were backed by the American state, and they yielded a higher rate of return than the Treasury bills did. So the whole world was involved in this credit bubble, and you got a crisis that was created this time not by the strength of labor, wage push inflation, but rather in some ways by the weakness of labor, by the role of credit in the system, mass credit in the system. And because it was a housing bubble, as Sam's often pointed out, it had immediate knock-on effects.
Well, Sam, you like to point out that, you know, the incorporation of the working class into the financial system is a very important development over the last couple of decades, right?
Yeah, it's very important with contradictions.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very important because as they lose their collective strength, they've tried to survive individually. And that in surviving individually has meant a range of things, from working longer hours, but including looking to financial markets to help them, the pensions and the stock market, even housing as an asset, but credit more generally.
And the working class now has a real material interest in financial stability.
Yes, and you know, one of the things that you can say about this crisis is that the American state did put a lid on the, you know, degeneration of this crisis into a Great Depression. In terms of the financial system, they contained the crisis, and I think that that's a very important part of it. They haven't been able to stimulate the economy, to revive the economy, and that raises a lot of, that's going to affect finance as well. And what Leo and I have been emphasizing is there's a number of contradictions here that are really important to bring out. One is that capitalism needs finance. It isn't just speculative. So the problem you have is that finance is necessary for the globalization of capital. They need it for risk, etc., derivatives, etc. But it's very volatile. So how do you balance this volatility versus the fact that you need it? You don't want to contain the volatility to the extent that you limit finance's role within capital.
And traders love volatility. They'd be very frustrated without it.
There's also this question that you know, we've been emphasizing, that you're still trying to keep the confidence of finance. Finance is still so fundamental to the system that you're trying to keep their confidence, and that trying to maintain the confidence of finance leads you to austerity, as it did during Depression as well, because finance is concerned about higher wages. It's concerned about whether it's going to lose the value of its assets to inflation, or in the cases of Europe and other countries, whether it's actually going to see default. And the other problem that I think has been very important in the work Leo's always done around the state is that this kind of empire relates to sovereign states. States are still sovereign. The United States can't just proclaim what happened. So it can look at Europe with some frustration, but it still has to depend on Europe working this out. So the system is very fragile.
They're not colonies.
All kinds of contradictions.
They're not colonies, and the Americans have had this trouble with the German central bankers since the 1970s.
There's Honduras and there's Germany, right?
There's Honduras and there's Germany, and Germany matters. And they've had to pull the German central bankers kicking and screaming to take responsibility for managing global capitalism since the banking crises of the 1970s. They've been very reluctant to do it. The American state in that sense has been far more interventionist, far more ready to take responsibility for managing the global system. The Germans have been much more particularist and narrow-minded. This isn't a new thing. Now, they put pressure on them in the last year, and you've seen a response. Nevertheless, as Sam says, this is not a colony. And it does involve a great deal of negotiation. In the end, we interviewed German central bankers, and they said to us, "We propose, the Americans dispose," which actually comes from the biographer of Keynes. Keynes allegedly said that of the Americans during World War II as well.
There's one thing that I think that you started with, Doug, that's important here, and that is that in the 30s, part of the reason that there was a solution that ended up saving capitalism was that the working class was actually strong enough to force certain things. And at this point in time, a stronger working class that was actually able to enforce some stimulus in the economy is probably what capitalism needs.
Yeah, the bourgeoisie has had it too easy lately.
Yeah.
We just about got another minute or two, but final question. Is America kaput?
No, well, America. American capitalism is not kaput. The world depends above all on the American state to be the core manager, container of crises, if possible. And American capital is by no means a basket case. If you look at multinational capital, if you look at new industries like biotech, pharmaceuticals, aerospace, you know, information technology, etc., it's not a basket case. And moreover, is capable of extensive exports. It's still a massive importer as well. There is a problem, which is that the corporations are sitting on their cash. They're not cash-starved by any means. Their profits are not low. They're not investing it.
I just look at this. Non-financial corporations have financial assets equal to almost 100% of GDP now.
You know, exactly. And that reflects the seriousness of this as a long period of stagnation. And it may well be that there is no way out of this than A, direct government spending and direct government employment, the exact opposite from what's been happening. And probably beyond that, a move towards turning the banks into public utilities so the decisions about what gets invested and where is taken in some form of democratic planning. The way in which the banks have been saved, and they have been saved, and then they've been given back all of their autonomy in terms of this judgment of what will happen to the liquid assets they're sitting on, is in many ways a democratic scandal. And it's scandalous that that is not being said often enough during the course, or at all, during the course of this election campaign.
Well, you got a private equity guy as a credible contender for the presidency.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, and in terms of it being kaput, one of the things it still has is that it's always got the ability to keep squeezing the American working class until the American working class actually responds. And you know, just to reemphasize what Leo was saying about the capacities it has in terms of high tech, but it's also services, which we often don't talk about as much. It's still, you know, the retail sector, its place in media and culture, its engineering, accounting, consultancy, all the kinds of business services that are so fundamental to capital everywhere. So it's in crisis, but there's a distinction to be made that's very important between capitalism facing a crisis right now and the notion that the American empire is about to disappear.